rise higher and reach further. Donate now at cjsffunddrive.ca or text DONATE to 778-782-2573.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We know and have known for months that Donald Trump would favor Andrew Cuomo as the mayor. They share the same donors. They share the same small vision. They share the same sense of impunity.
It's election day in many parts of the United States. Here in New York, Democratic Socialist mayoral candidate Zoran Mamdani spoke out Monday after President Trump and Elon Musk endorsed former Governor Andrew Cuomo. We'll get the latest on the New York mayoral race and other critical races, as well as Proposition 50 in California. Then, former Vice President Dick Cheney has died at the age of 84. He was a key architect of the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the U.S. torture program after 9/11.
What we did in Iraq was exactly the right thing to do. If I had it to recommend all over again, I would recommend exactly the right same course of action.
We'll speak to the nation's John Nichols, author of The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney, Unlocking the Mysteries of the Most Powerful Vice President in American History. Then to Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters Carol Lenig and Aaron Davis about their blockbuster new book out today, Injustice, How Politics and Fear Vanquished America's Justice Department. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. It's election day here in the United States. Voters in New Jersey and Virginia are casting their ballots for governor. Meanwhile, voters in California will be weighing in on a new set of congressional maps pushed by Governor Gavin Newsom that could give Democrats a five-seat advantage in Congress. That's in response to the GOP-led Texas state legislature passing congressional maps earlier this year that would enable Republicans to pick up five additional House seats. Here in New York City, Democratic nominee Zoran Mamdani is running against former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and Republican Curtis Sliwa to succeed outgoing Mayor Eric Adams. President Trump last night threw his support behind Cuomo and threatened to restrict federal funds for New York City if Mamdani wins. This is Zoran Mamdani's response.
It is a threat. It is not the law. And too often we treat everything that comes out of Donald Trump's mouth as if it is already legal just by virtue of who is saying it. And it is time to finally stand up to the bullies that make these threats, not to become the bullies ourselves.
The world's richest person, billionaire Elon Musk, is also urging New Yorkers to vote for Cuomo, writing on X, quote, "Bear in mind that a vote for Curtis is really a vote for Mum Dummy or whatever his name is," Musk tweeted, intentionally misspelling and mocking Mamdani's name. After headlines, we'll have more on what's at stake this election day with John Nichols, executive editor of The Nation. The U.S. federal government shutdown has entered its 35th day, tying the record with the longest shutdown in history, with no end in sight. It comes as the Trump administration agreed to comply with a court order to partially fund food benefits to 42 million people. The Department of Agriculture announced it'll tap into a contingency fund to provide only half of the benefits under SNAP. That's the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program. Democratic Congress member Rashida Tlaib said, quote, "It shouldn't take a court order to get the president to stop starving families families and release the funds, she said. On Monday, Republican Senator John Barrasso blocked a Democratic bill demanding full funding for SNAP benefits. About one in eight U.S. residents get an average of $187 a month in food benefits from the government. This is Jessica Alisea, SNAP recipient in Virginia.
I know what it's like to give my kids food and not eat for the night. I know what it's like to make sure that at the end of the day, my kids have all that they need while I go without.
In labor news, several major U.S. companies have announced layoffs affecting tens of thousands of workers. Amazon said it'll eliminate about 14,000 corporate jobs, with Reuters reporting that number could more than double as artificial intelligence tools increasingly replace white-collar workers. Meanwhile, Target announced plans to cut 1,800 corporate jobs. General Motors said it's cutting over 3,300 electric vehicle jobs, and Paramount began laying off 2,000 workers following the media conglomerate's merger with Skydance. Meanwhile, shipping giant UPS said it's eliminated some 48,000 jobs this year. Last week, the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates for the second consecutive meeting as Fed Chair Jerome Powell warned of a weakening labor market. The Fed's decision came in the absence of key data on inflation and employment due to the government shutdown. The 10 richest Americans have seen their wealth collectively grow by $700 billion since President Trump's return to office. That's according to a report by Oxfam America, which details that this year the share of total U.S. assets held by the richest 0.1% of Americans reached its highest level on record at 12.6%. Abby Maxman, president and CEO of Oxfam America, said, quote, "Now the Trump administration and Republicans in Congress risk turbocharging that inequality as they wage a relentless attack on working people and bargain with livelihoods during the government shutdown," unquote. Former Vice President Dick Cheney has died at the age of 84. Beginning in 1978, Cheney served six terms as Wyoming's lone U.S. congressmember, where he voted against a resolution calling for the release of Nelson Mandela in South Africa and against a holiday for Martin Luther King Jr. He left Congress in 1989 to serve as defense secretary under President George H.W. Bush, overseeing the first Gulf War and the U.S. invasion of Panama that deposed leader and former U.S. ally Manuel Noriega, while killing hundreds of people. From 1995 to 2000, Cheney served as chair and CEO of the oil services company Halliburton before George W. Bush tapped him as his running mate. As vice president, Cheney was a key architect of the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq under the false pretext of preventing Saddam Hussein from developing weapons of mass destruction. The invasion led to more than 650,000 deaths, according to a study by The Lancet. As the occupation of Iraq foundered, Cheney argued for the Salvador option, using death squads similar to U.S.-supported paramilitaries in El Salvador and other Central American countries in the 1980s. Dick Cheney steadfastly defended the use of torture against detainees of the so-called War on Terror. This is Cheney speaking to Meet the Press just days after the 9/11 attacks in 2001.
We also have to work, though, sort of the dark side, if you will. We've got to spend time in the shadows and in the intelligence world. A lot of what needs to be done here will have to be done quietly, without any discussion, using sources and methods that are available to our intelligence agencies, if we're going to be successful.
We'll have more on Vice President Dick Cheney's life and legacy later in the broadcast. In Sudan, the UN's migration agency says more than 36,000 people have fled Al-Fashir since the city was seized by the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces last week after 18 months under siege. Displaced families were forced to walk to the neighboring town of Tuwila that's already sheltering more than 650,000 people forced out of their homes. Survivors describe streets littered with corpses and families separated by violence, with those displaced forced to trek for days without food or water. This comes as famine grips Al-Fashir, and the town of Kadugli, according to a report by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, the world's leading authority on food crises. Famine is also threatening to spread to 20 other areas in the Darfur region and central Sudan's Kordofan region as fighting between the Sudanese government and the RSF rages on. Meanwhile, the RSF vowed to take over the city of El Obeid in central Sudan, currently under control by the Sudanese army. Israel's continuing to intensify its attacks across Gaza, further violating the U.S.-brokered truce that went into effect October 10th. Al Jazeera reports Israeli forces have demolished homes and residential buildings in Gaza City, as Palestinian families still don't have access to enough food, clean water, medicines, or safe shelter with winter approaching. There are an estimated 75,000 displaced people sheltering in overcrowded UNRWA-run buildings damaged by Israeli attacks, while tens of thousands of others are living in makeshift refugee camps in Gaza or amidst the rubble of what was once their homes. This is a Palestinian man in Khan Yunis.
Today, the basic necessities aren't available. Meat isn't available and chicken isn't either. As for the situation of vegetables today, it's unpredictable. Sometimes prices go up, sometimes they go down. The situation is hard. We can't bear it. We're living in tents. All our lives we've prayed for winter rain, but today we hope winter doesn't come because we will be humiliated in tents.
Israel's released the bodies of another 45 Palestinians after Hamas returned the remains of three Israeli soldiers. As of Monday, Israel's handed over the bodies of at least 270 Palestinians since the U.S.-backed Gaza deal went into effect last month. Israel's also released another five Palestinians in Israeli prison custody. The men were taken to Gaza's Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah for medical care. Many of the bodies and Palestinian captives released by Israel show signs of torture and abuse. It's estimated Israel still holds the remains of about 1,500 Palestinians from Gaza. This all comes as fallout continues following the arrest of a former top lawyer of the Israeli military for her role in the leak of surveillance video that showed Israeli soldiers gang-raping a Palestinian prisoner at the Sde Tamon prison last year. Major General Yifat Tomer Yerushalmi was arrested on Sunday in what now Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has called Israel's worst PR attack in its history. He's yet to condemn the rape of the Palestinian prisoner, who has since been released to Gaza. In Southern California, advocates are raising more alarm over ICE's use of force in immigration raids after agents shot a 25-year-old U.S. citizen in the Los Angeles area as he attempted to warn the federal officers that children would soon gather at a school bus stop where the officers had just pulled over a vehicle. Lawyers for Carlos Jimenez said he was shot while trying to leave the scene and reversed his car in panic. A bullet remains lodged in the back of his right shoulder. Jimenez was then arrested, accused of assaulting an officer, which his lawyers deny. He was released from jail on bond last week as he faces federal charges. The shooting came about a week after ICE agents shot a Mexican immigrant they were attempting to arrest during a botched operation in Los Angeles late last month. In more immigration news, two separate courts have ordered the Trump administration not to deport a man who spent 43 years in a Pennsylvania prison for a crime he did not commit. On October 3rd, 64-year-old Subramaniam Vedam walked free from Huntingdon State Correctional Institution, where he'd been held for over four decades, after his conviction for a 1982 murder was vacated. His freedom came 3 years after the Pennsylvania Innocence Project uncovered evidence that prosecutors had buried an FBI report that would have exonerated him. He was immediately arrested by ICE agents. Vedam is currently detained at an ICE jail in Alexandria, Louisiana. Vedam came to the U.S. from India with his parents when he was just 9 months old. In the Philippines, at least 26 people were killed, tens of thousands forced to flee their communities as Typhoon Kalmagi struck central provinces with destructive winds and heavy rains. The storm triggered flash flooding that trapped residents on rooftops and swallowed up homes and vehicles. It was the 20th tropical cyclone to strike the Philippines this year. And in more climate news, the Trump administration said Saturday the U.S. will not send any high-level officials to the United Nations COP30 climate talks in Belém, Brazil, when delegates gather later this month. Democracy Now! Will be broadcasting from COP30 in Belém. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
It's Election Day here in the U.S. We begin the show looking at some of the key races. Voters in New Jersey and Virginia are casting their ballots for governor. Meanwhile, voters in California will weigh in on a new set of congressional maps backed by Governor Gavin Newsom that could give Democrats a five-seat advantage in Congress. The ballot initiative known as Prop 50 is a response to the GOP-led Texas state legislature passing congressional maps earlier this year that would enable Republicans to pick up five additional seats in the House of Representatives. In statewide races, voters will choose three seats on Pennsylvania's Supreme Court. Legislative chambers in New Jersey and Virginia, Minnesota, Mississippi, and Washington could all potentially flip control. This comes as dozens of cities are voting on mayoral races, including Detroit, Minneapolis, and Seattle. Perhaps the closest watch mayoral race in the country is right here in New York City, where Democratic nominee Zohran Mamdani is running against former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and Republican Curtis Sliwa to succeed outgoing Mayor Eric Adams. Billionaire Elon Musk is urging voters to vote for Cuomo, writing on X, quote, "Bear in mind that a vote for Curtis is really a vote for Mum Dummy or whatever his name is," clearly intentionally mocking Mamdani's name. President Trump is also throwing his support behind Cuomo and has threatened to restrict federal funds for New York City if Mamdani wins. Mamdani responded Monday night.
But I want to take a moment to speak about who is on the ballot tonight. Donald Trump just put out a statement encouraging New Yorkers, saying they must vote for Andrew Cuomo. We know and have known for months that Donald Trump would favor Andrew Cuomo as the mayor. They share the same donors. They share the same small vision. They share the same sense of impunity. And yet in these final days, what was rumored, what was feared, has become naked and unabashed. The MAGA movement's embrace of Andrew Cuomo is reflective of Donald Trump's understanding that this would be the best mayor for him. Not the best mayor for New York City, not the best mayor for New Yorkers, but the best mayor for Donald Trump and his administration.
For more, we're joined by John Nichols, executive editor of The Nation, where he was previously the national affairs correspondent, Washington, D.C. correspondent. His new piece is headlined, "Bernie Sanders Says a Mamdani Win Can Transform American Politics," unquote. John Nichols is the author of many books, including The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney, Unlocking the Mysteries of the Most Powerful Vice President in American History, which we'll talk about in a minute, upon the death of Dick Cheney. But first, we look at the races around the country, beginning with Zohran Mamdani. You have this exclusive interview with Bernie Sanders, who says that this is the key race. Talk about what's happening in New York now with President Trump endorsing his opponent. Again, Mamdani is the Democratic nominee, won the Democratic primary, and followed by Elon Musk endorsing Andrew Cuomo as well.
Look, whether you are a Republican or a Democrat, a progressive or a conservative, a Democratic socialist or whatever might be on the other side, Zohran Mamdani has captured the imagination of the country. I've traveled a lot around the U.S. in recent weeks. And when I mention Mom Donnie in rural towns in Wisconsin or, in California, wherever, there's excitement, there's interest. People want to hear about him. They want to talk about him. And so it is not surprising that Donald Trump and Elon Musk and others have focused in on this race. This is the largest city in the United States. It is a city that, again, in many ways captures the imagination of the country and the world. And the candidate who is leading in the polls at this point is the Democratic nominee in a very Democratic city, is a 34-year-old Uganda-born Muslim Democratic socialist. And so by almost any measure, this is someone who opens up new vistas for our politics, who suggests how we might have a very different politics ideologically and frankly, in the character and quality of communications that's related to an office. Mamdani has proven to be a brilliant communicator and someone who is able to speak to issues that his own party has failed to speak to anywhere nearly as effectively as he does. And at the center of that is a message about putting a major city and really ultimately putting the politics of the country on the side of the working class, of people who are struggling to get by economically and clearly aligning government with those who have not had a lot of power up to this point. So, yes, this is a huge election in New York. As Bernie Sanders said, it could well define new directions for the Democratic Party and the country. And it also would be, if Mamdani wins tonight, be a blow to President Trump, because President Trump has tried so hard to prevent this man from becoming mayor of New York.
John, I wanted to ask you, taking a more historical perspective on this, while I agree with you that the Mamdani campaign is really electrifying, it's not the first time that we've had someone who claims to be a Democratic Socialist running. Fiorello LaGuardia was a Democratic Socialist. People forget that David Dinkins, when he ran for mayor, was a member of Democratic Socialists of America. So these firsts have occurred previously. The question is, what would be the systemic change that could possibly come from Mamdani capturing the New York City mayoralty?
Sure, you're absolutely right, Juan. There's a lot of history. And as you and I know, as being friends for a very long time, I've written a lot about this over the years. I come from Wisconsin, and in my native state of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, through much of the 20th century, had Socialist Party mayors, and they were very effective mayors. In fact, they're looked back on with great fondness because of how well they governed. And so one thing that we have to remember is that socialists have been established in this country as effective mayors in many, many cities, in Milwaukee and other cities. And yes, there is this legacy in New York City, which Zoran Mamdani has embraced. He talks a lot about Fiorello LaGuardia. He talks a lot about others who came before him. And the shift that would occur now, what is significant is that in deciding to run for mayor about roughly a year ago, Zoran Mamdani did something that I think too few political figures do. He actually analyzed what was on people's minds, what was really worrying them, what they saw as the fundamental challenges in their lives. And he came to an argument about affordability, the simple ability to get by in what is a very expensive city. And so he went to practical moves that people could understand very easily. He didn't have to go to some big policy paper. He wants to have fast and free buses so you can get to work or get to where you need to go. He wants to freeze the rent in a city where it's becoming very, very hard to get by and very, very hard to pay for your place. He wants to have universal childcare and child education. He wants to fund education in all sorts of ways. And he wants to go even into, you know, some more fundamental challenges of people living in some parts of New York where we have what are described as food deserts. And he talks about the idea of opening municipally run grocery stores to make sure that people have safe and healthy food. None of these are radical proposals. These are all proposals that can practically be done in New York City. Now, there's no question Donald Trump will seek to make that dramatically harder by holding up funds and with a host of other initiatives. The state of New York will become a challenge. There are hoops that have to be jumped through, barriers that have to be broken down. But Mamdani has a vision for how to do this. He can do some of it as mayor. He can do some of it in collaboration with New York State. And then ultimately, you ask about how this will work. I think that I've interviewed Mamdani about this, and along with Katrina Vandenhoevel, our editor at The Nation. And what he is very conscious of is that he broke through the barriers within the Democratic Party because of his ability to communicate, because of his skills at reaching out to people and talking to them where they live in about issues that they really care about. He will continue to do that as mayor. And so I think we're going to see a very different kind of mayoralty, a mayor who really does seek to rally the people of the city in a way that perhaps we haven't seen since LaGuardia was mayor. And remember, just as Zoran Mamdani has mastered social media in this area, in this era, LaGuardia mastered radio and was an incredibly skilled communicator and also somebody who's very active throughout the city. And I think anybody who's watched the current campaign knows that Mamdani has been almost unimaginably active in going to every part of the city, showing up where people are, and doing it with an openness that I do think draws people in. So I think he has the potential to be a rallying mayor.
John, if you could just talk briefly also about two other mayoral races that are occurring today, Seattle and Minneapolis.
Yes. Both of these cities have candidates who've been compared with Mamdani. Omar Fattah in Minneapolis, Katie Wilson in Seattle. And the thing to understand about what's happening in municipal politics across the country, I think, is that we are seeing in our cities, in this era of Donald Trump, in this era of power politics coming out of Washington, we're seeing that our cities are often the places that are targeted by Trump on many issues, but also places where there is an ability to create a different politics, a different approach to governing. And so there are in both Seattle and in Minneapolis candidacies that, like in New York, challenge not just the Republican Party as we know it, but also in many senses challenge the Democratic Party and say that the Democratic Party can be an activist party that uses government to really tip the balance in favor of the working class, in favor of people who have been targeted by Trump, and doesn't just seek to defend them, but seeks to make their lives better. So, yes, tonight we're going to watch races across the country, and those aren't the only ones. We could go into smaller cities and other places across this country.
And then there's the governor's race, John. We only have 2 minutes on this segment. There's the governor's races in both Virginia and New Jersey.
Yes. Both of those states are real traditional battlegrounds in an off-year election. In each of those states, you have women running to become governor, with Democratic nominees, who are more moderate. I think that's true of Abigail Spanberger and also of Mikey Sherrill. But they have run against Trump in many senses. They have sought to suggests that if they are elected, they will battle against many of the cuts that come from the federal level. Now, in New Jersey, they have a Democratic governor now. So if the Democrat wins there, it will be continuity. But in Virginia, they have a Republican governor. If the Republican wins, or if the Democrat wins in Virginia, that's flipping a major state. And I think, again, if you start to see this pattern across the country, not saying it will happen, we have to watch the results, but if you see this pattern of Democrats winning in a lot of places, that's clearly a message to Donald Trump.
And you're in San Francisco right now, John Nichols. We just have 30 seconds on Prop 50. And then, of course, we'll talk more about all these races tomorrow after the results are in. Prop 50.
Sure. Yeah, Prop 50 is an effort by Gavin Newsom and Democrats in California to offset what Donald Trump did in pressured Texas to do, which is flip five traditionally Republican seats toward the, or traditionally Democratic seats toward the Republicans. California is seeking to do the reverse of that. This is the beginning, not the end, of gerrymandering and redistricting wars that we're going to see all over the country. And it is evidence of the great battle for control of Congress in 2026. The one thing to, I think, take away is that all evidence in California is that Prop 50 is doing very, very well, and that voters actually get what is at stake here, that this is an opportunity to push back against Donald Trump.
John Nichols is executive editor of The Nation. When we come back, we'll talk with him about the death of former Vice President Dick Cheney, who many call the most powerful vice president in U.S. history. Stay with us.
Stand behind his drunken amp. Stand behind his light of love. Hear him yell.